This week, with only hours remaining before funding expires, how can the world's largest economy be facing a government shutdown again?
There is something to be said here that this is forcing Democrats and Republicans to compromise with each other.
And what are the political implications for American politicians?
I think there's going to be a lot of hesitation by even moderate Republicans to work with the Democrats. However, they've already had to take some votes that they would rather not have to take.
Plus, most ethnic Armenians have evacuated Nagorno-Karabakh this week. What impact could this have on the region? Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hello, I'm Steve Miller. The U.S. House of Representatives rejected Friday a Republican short-term spending measure aimed at averting a government shutdown, raising the odds that federal agencies will cease operations at 12:01 a.m. Sunday on October 1st. So, how can the world's largest economy be facing a government shutdown and be unable to pay its workers? Well, that's the question many inside as well as outside the United States are asking. And VOA's Carolyn Pursuti has the answer.
The new fiscal year begins October 1st. Prior to that, Congress must pass appropriation bills to fund federal government programs and keep the country running. But a group of Republican lawmakers has threatened to oppose any bill that does not also address their political priorities, including deep spending cuts, increased border security, reducing aid to Ukraine, and even the impeachment of President Joe Biden. Since the Anti-Deficiency Act prohibits government spending without authorization by Congress, failure to pass these bills before a September 30th deadline would result in a partial government shutdown. During a shutdown, the federal government ceases all non-mandatory spending. Many federal employees who are not considered essential workers are furloughed. This stops many day-to-day functions, including food and safety inspection, running national parks, and processing benefits and grants. Essential programs and services such as defense, border security, air traffic control, and energy maintenance can often continue running under contingency plans. But even those will be affected in their ability to pay workers and plan ahead. Aside from directly affecting thousands of federal employees, a shutdown would dent growth of the economy by about 0.2% weekly until the shutdown ends. The last government shutdown lasted 5 weeks and cost an estimated $3 billion in GDP. Because affected services include everything from visa applications to reviews of foreign investment, the impact would be felt globally. While shutdowns lasting more than one business day were relatively rare until the 1990s, the past decade has seen two extended shutdowns, with the longest, again the most recent, lasting 35 days.
VOA's Carolyn Pursuti. Now, a U.S. government shutdown is looking inevitable for Sunday as lawmakers remain at odds over the size of the U.S. budget for the next 12 months. Joining us to further explain the goings-on inside the House of Representatives is Catherine Gibson, VOA's congressional correspondent. So, Catherine, here we are on Friday afternoon, hours away from a potential government shutdown. And while that is still in the distant future for us, can you kind of walk our international audience through how we got here and why this is happening yet again?
Well, what it really comes down to is that the Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives have a very slim majority. So whenever Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy wants to pass legislation in the Republican majority U.S. House, he really has to bring every single member of his caucus along on that legislation. They all have to agree to whatever policy is up for a vote. And the problem here is that Speaker McCarthy has a very conservative wing of the Republican Party in the U.S. House that is unhappy with his leadership, that is unhappy with the spending levels of the U.S. government, and has long made the argument that there need to be some budget cuts for the United States to be more fiscally responsible. Now, of course, the problem is that doesn't hold water for many moderate Republicans in the U.S. House. It certainly doesn't for the Democrats in there. And any legislation that they pass would never pass the Democratic majority U.S. Senate. So what we really need to see here in the U.S. government is compromise. And that's something that conservative members of the party so far have been unwilling to do.
So, Catherine, you mentioned compromise. Earlier this year, this summer, in fact, Joe Biden, the U.S. president and Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, came up with a compromise. Why? And that's something that the Democrats are saying we shouldn't be going through this right now because we've already had this discussion on appropriations, on a compromise.
Well, we were just hearing from House Democratic leadership up here on Capitol Hill, and they were saying, look, we did have this debate earlier in the year. Speaker McCarthy, as you mentioned, made a deal with President Joe Biden about those spending levels. And now they feel betrayed and they feel like Speaker McCarthy is going back on that promise. And that's why that we're in this situation. The problem is that Speaker McCarthy, once again, needs those conservative members to maintain his speakership. There's a lot of talk up on Capitol Hill right now that if Speaker McCarthy cuts a deal with Democrats, that if he goes back to those levels that he agreed upon earlier in the summer with President Biden, that he is going to face a leadership challenge from those conservative House members, that they are going to move to remove him from the speakership. So McCarthy is in an incredibly difficult position right now. He needs to cut a deal to keep the government open, but he can't cut a deal because that will cost him his speakership.
Speaking of compromise, Catherine, one last question. Earlier, there was a bill that was put forward by a pair of bipartisan senators that would essentially codify, make it a law that future shutdowns wouldn't be happening. They wanted to institute a policy that should there be disagreements over appropriations, an automatic 2-week funding short-term spending gap bill would be placed into effect and fund the government fully to focus lawmakers on addressing the larger appropriations issue in perpetuity until a final agreement be made. You mentioned the slim majority that Republicans have in the House, but you know, is there any kind of traction that would see something like that happen to avoid future instances of government shutdowns?
Yeah, you know, it is a difficult position for many moderate Republicans to be in. Some of them are in districts that President Joe Biden won. So they are, of course, like every lawmaker in Washington, D.C. right now, looking ahead to 2024 and the elections when they will be up to renew their jobs again. They're thinking about how all of this is playing back home with their constituents, some of whom are government employees, some of whom are members of the military who won't be paid, people who will hold them to account. And it's a strange thing because we go through this discussion every time there's a government shutdown. There's legislation introduced to make sure that this doesn't happen. There's legislation to make sure that, you know, members of Congress who instituted the shutdown don't get paid. There's always a lot of talk around trying to avoid these situations. And yet we do seem to find ourselves in these same situations every year. And so I understand for our international listeners that this looks chaotic from the outside. That's completely understandable. But there is something to be said here that this is forcing Democrats and Republicans to compromise with each other. Yes, the government may shut down. It may even shut down for several weeks. It has in the past. But eventually, lawmakers will find a compromise.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. As always, Catherine, thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Anytime.
U.S. President Joe Biden is staying in Washington over the weekend to remain in contact with leaders from both parties. On Friday, the Democratic executive didn't hold back his thoughts when delivering remarks at U.S. General Mark Milley's farewell event.
I've been here a long time. I've never seen anything like this. It's outrageous.
And last week, Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell urged the House to pass a bipartisan spending bill.
I think all of you know I'm not a fan of government shutdowns. I've seen a few of them over the years. They never have produced a policy change, and they've always been a loser for Republicans.
Joining us to discuss the political implications of the U.S. government facing another shutdown is Annalise Russell, at the Martin School of Public Policy and Administration at the University of Kentucky. So, are there any winners in a government shutdown, and why are we here yet again?
Well, I guess maybe the winner is, at this point so far, is maybe Matt Gaetz, because he just booked a Sunday show. But I think at this point, right, I don't think anyone would agree that this is an ideal situation, but everyone is also unclear as to what the remedy is going to be. This shutdown is largely a result of McCarthy's political tightrope that he has to walk with his conference. And he also operates increasingly in a world where political presentation, right, can mean power. And shutdowns highlight the ability of a few to foster sort of partisan media success. And so he's really up against a rock and a hard place in trying to figure out what the next steps are going to be.
You know, in terms of next steps, what do you see as political avenues for both Republicans and Democrats? Because if we step back and look at the broader aspect of government shutdowns, both parties have kind of held the purse strings of the U.S. Congress before.
Right. And I think they've unfortunately had experience here. The question then becomes, is there a blame game to avoid? And are we in a media climate where that blame game can actually have electoral repercussions? It's unclear, right? We had this happen in 1995, and Newt Gingrich got the short side of the stick in that shutdown. But are we in a time where there are going to be Republicans, particularly in heavily conservative districts, who will actually see repercussions from this? And so you may not have the electoral concerns that you might have had 20, 30 years ago. And so some of that, and then elections in 2024, may play a part in this. But I think a lot of this is going to be figuring out how McCarthy brings his conference together.
You know, speaking about coming together, you know, in the House of Representatives, there's that narrow, narrow margin that Republicans have. And equally so, to some extent, in the Senate, you know, Democrats have an even slimmer majority there. But on the Senate side, there is bipartisan support to push things through. There was even a bill put forward to try and mitigate future appropriation pitfalls so that there would always be at least a 2-week continuing resolution to move the process forward. So are there any considerations that you would see, say, for moderate Republicans in the House that may say, okay, you know, since I am looking at another contest in 2024 to retain my seat, do you see a potential shift that says, okay, I'm going to side with the Democrats and just push something through, irregardless of what happens to Speaker McCarthy?
I think there's going to be a lot of hesitation by even moderate Republicans to work with the Democrats. However, they've already had to take some votes that they would rather not have to take, right? You've got a Senate where bipartisanship tends to happen more often because a single senator can disrupt the process, right? You need collaborative support to move things in the Senate in ways you just don't need in the House. And so the House doesn't have the same bipartisan vein. There's a lot more majority party politics. That's the way the game is played. Not always. But today it's hard to see, even though there are incentives potentially for some moderate Republicans who very well may have tough races ahead, there's also not enough of them to prove a true counter to some of the more conservative or right-leaning members of the conference. And so they're really in sort of a bind where they would like to be able to keep the government open. They want to move forward, but they may not and probably don't have the political power, it very much so within their own conference, to do so.
You know, one last question as we get ready to go into the weekend. You mentioned Matt Gaetz booking a Sunday show. And for those outside the United States, those are the big political discussion shows on television in the United States. What are you looking towards and looking at in terms of the general political discourse in America as this specific topic moves forward and we inch closer to that November 2024 election?
I think you're going to get a persistence of conflict, who's to blame, and you're going to get increased presentation and communication on this issue. So after contentious votes on Friday, you had four conservative critics of McCarthy's hopping on a podcast after a failed vote to immediately give context, give perspective. And that deference to digital communication, that deference to co-partisans, really signals where our communication climate, our public opinion is. And you've got lawmakers who see positive gains from this sort of presidential conflict presentation that's really going to be a challenge and continue to be a challenge for McCarthy in the coming months and leading into 2024.
Annalise Russell is an assistant professor at the Martin School of Public Policy and Administration at the University of Kentucky. Annalise, it was a pleasure speaking with you today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Steve Miller. Ethnic Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh said on Thursday that they were dissolving the breakaway enclave that they had defended for three decades, and refugees were continuing to cross into Armenia by the thousands. By Friday, most of the ethnic Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh had evacuated. For additional insight into the conflict, Kim Lewis spoke with Matthew Droin, visiting fellow with the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
There is a very troubled history between Armenia and Azerbaijan, especially since they gained their independence from the Soviet Union, including two wars, one that ended in 1994 with an Armenian victory over Azerbaijan, and a second war in 2020 with an Azerbaijan victory over Armenia. And so basically the intent of Azerbaijan has always been to regain full control of this small enclave with the majority of ethnic Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh, since this enclave is surrounded by the Azerbaijan territory. So yes, what we have seen this past few days is certainly the conclusion or the epilogue of this series of wars and tensions.
What happened with the European-led effort to bring longer-term peace to the region?
Well, obviously, they haven't prevented Azerbaijan to launch their offensive. Azerbaijan has weighed the fact that Russia, which was supposed to protect the ceasefire and protect the Nagorno-Karabakh, would not prevent or intervene against Azerbaijani troops. So basically, Azerbaijan fulfilled its goal. I guess the EU-led mediation is not buried. There will be a new meeting next week in Granada, in Spain, with both leaders, the Armenian leader and Azerbaijani leader, under the auspices of the European Union, Charles Michel, also the French president and the German chancellor. So of course, the Nagorno-Karabakh issue is probably now terminated. But there are other issues pending between Armenia and Azerbaijan that still need to be discussed.
Can you talk a little bit more about Russia's role in the conflict?
Russia has been the main player to broker a ceasefire in the second war in 2020. It got a commitment to deploy around 2,000 troops in Nagorno-Karabakh to protect the ceasefire. But the fact is that Russia is fully absorbed by the war in Ukraine. So Azerbaijan and its main support, Turkey, have tested Russian resolve to protect Nagorno-Karabakh over the past few months. The Azerbaijani authorities have launched a blockade of the so-called Lachin Corridor, which is the only corridor that links Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh. And basically, the Russian troops have done nothing. So they felt that there was a window for launching their offensive. So, and this is why Armenian leaders and people in Yerevan are very angry at Russia, because they feel that they have been abandoned.
Azerbaijan says there is a future for Armenians in Karabakh and they don't want an exodus. However, Armenians say they fear an ethnic cleansing there, which is why they have been fleeing. What does the future hold for Armenians at this point?
So basically, even whatever the Azerbaijani authorities say, it is quite obvious for most, if not the totality of Armenians that lived in Nagorno-Karabakh, that there's no future for them in the country. There is deeply entrenched hatred between Azerbaijanis and Armenians. because of the past wars. So it might take some time, but there's no really other option that most, if not all, Armenians live in Nagorno-Karabakh.
That was visiting fellow with the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Matthew Joyne, speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis. Also, VOA's Steve Karish caught up with Oscar Asgarov, managing editor of VOA's Azerbaijani service, to discuss the humanitarian situation and the future of Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Russian relations.
The United States activated a disaster assistance response team to respond to the humanitarian needs in the South Caucasus, already having pledged $11.5 million in assistance to those in need. The head of USAID, Samantha Power, just visited Armenia and Azerbaijan to discuss the ongoing crisis with the top officials of those countries.
Now, we know that Azerbaijan has essentially taken over the Nagorno-Karabakh region, and they've said they will protect the rights and the safety of the Armenian citizens there. Has that been happening?
Well, the Azerbaijani government officials have stated that they are ready to guarantee the rights and safety of Karabakh Armenians in accordance with the constitution. One does not know how many Karabakh Armenians will be reassured of that. The images we're seeing coming from the area are that many do not. And the main questions right now are how many Armenians will remain in Karabakh and how those who do would integrate into the Azerbaijani society and continue to live under Azerbaijani governance.
Has that been a peaceful coexistence before this most recent hostility?
No, this is a continuation of a conflict that goes back to late 1980s when the conflict erupted over Nagorno-Karabakh. Armenia and Azerbaijan were both under the rule of Moscow at the time, but as Soviet Union collapsed in 1991 and these two countries became independent, it turned into a full-blown war in the years of 1992-94, and then there was a ceasefire in 1994, which essentially froze the conflict. And with the exception of occasional flare-ups and clashes, the status quo pretty much held until September of 2020, when what observers call the Second Karabakh War broke out. And since then, the tensions have remained high in the region, and what transpired last week was pretty much the continuation of the adversarial relations that Azerbaijan and Armenia had over this region.
Now, we know there were Russian peacekeepers on the ground. How does this situation affect the relationship between Baku and Moscow and Armenia and Moscow? Geopolitically, what's going to happen next?
Well, I think one can observe with some degree of certainty that the Russian influence has waned in South Caucasus. It's not just that the relations between the government of Nikol Pashinyan and Vladimir Putin have been rocky for the last several years. I think it's just the observable fact that the Russian presence is not what it used to be. I think the Russian invasion of Ukraine has significantly depleted Russia's political, military, and some degree moral capital to mediate or to influence the developments in the region. But I'd say it's more than that. The Second Karabakh War took place in 2020 when Russia had not yet invaded Ukraine. And I think it was a testament to the growing Turkish influence in South Caucasus. Azerbaijan's strong political and economic military ties are not just with Turkey, but also with Israel, have changed the dynamics in the region.
Oscar Asgarov is managing editor of VOA's Azerbaijani service. Oscar, thanks for your analysis. Thanks for your reporting on this issue.
And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of everyone at VOA, we thank you for listening. For more news throughout the week, be sure to listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us again next week for more issues in the news. And until then, I'm Steve Miller.